a conversation about the many layers to the conflict in the Middle East.
Frankly, nobody knows how many of the Israeli hostages are still alive. One thing we know is that this is further delayed. Most of them, if not all of them, will not come back to Israel except in coffins.
Plus, the Ukraine funding bill heading for a vote.
So this is Speaker Johnson's last chance to be part of the solution and not be sidelined. And he has a very real incentive to actually pass something here.
And later, elections are coming to Chad and India. Today is Thursday, April 18th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A developing story from New York, where diplomatic sources say that a UN Security Council vote on Palestinian membership to the UN will take place Thursday evening. We'll have more on this on Friday's show, and you can always get the latest developments on voanews.com. Meanwhile, in other diplomatic news, foreign ministers from the Group of Seven Nations are discussing tensions in the Middle East during their meeting in Capri, Italy. Their agenda is topped by calls for targeted new sanctions against Iran over its attack against Israel and more aid to Ukraine to fight against Russia's invasion.
Stiamo lavorando insieme per garantire pace, crescita, stabilità.
That's Italian Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani. He told the Associated Press on Wednesday that Italy supports targeted new sanctions against Tehran, specifically against the makers of drones. David Cameron is Britain's foreign secretary.
But given Iran's behavior in backing the Houthis, backing Hezbollah, backing Hamas, and, of course, the appalling state-on-state attack on Israel, it's quite right that with partners we take further action on sanctions. And that's what Britain has done today, sanctioning a further 13 people and entities to add to the already 400 sanctions that we've put in place. Iran's behavior is unacceptable, and it's right that countries come together here at the G7 and make those points, not just because of what Iran has been doing, but also as a message to Israel that we want to play our part in having a coordinated strategy that deals with Iran's aggression that we saw so clearly against Israel over the weekend.
And for its part, the United States announced on Thursday sanctions against 16 Iranian individuals and entities involved in drone production. Along with representatives from the G7 countries, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, European Union's top diplomat Josep Borrell, and African Union President Mohamed Salem Merzoug are also attending the conference. Iran's unprecedented aerial assault on Israel over the weekend has not been universally welcomed inside the Islamic Republic. Several organizations for Iranian students, academics, teachers, and retirees issued statements condemning their Islamist rulers for carrying out the attack. Some of them described it as an act of adventurism that will ultimately hurt the Iranian people. Holly Douglas is an Iran analyst and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and curator of the Iranist newsletter on Substack. My colleague Michael Lippin asked her what the most interesting reactions are that she's observed in Iran.
There's been an array of reactions out of Iran, predominantly on social media. There's a lot of trepidation on the ground. I mean, Iranians have a memory of the bloody Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. But as we speak right now, yes, they're living their lives. But I think what's hanging in the back of their head is whether Israel would retaliate directly on Iranian soil. Israel has, of course, said it would respond, but we're not sure of how. And so we've seen a lot of mixed reactions. We've seen graffiti on Iran, some of which have said, like, the enemy of my enemy is not my friend, insinuating that just because Israel's enemy of the Islamic Republic, it doesn't mean like an attack on Iranian soil is something they support. But we've also seen things like, hit them, Israel. They don't have the guts to retaliate or respond.
And when you see they don't have the guts to respond, that refers to the Islamic Republic?
Yes. And the people that are kind of pushing for some sort of response, it's out of desperation. They're fed up with the status quo. They want the Islamic Republic gone. And so they're hoping that maybe they'll take out Iran's leadership or nuclear or defense facilities. But as you and I know, if you do something along those lines, that would possibly very likely lead to an all-out war in the region.
Which it doesn't seem the Iranian people really want.
No. And that's why a lot of people are worried about, well, this could lead to a wide-scale war. And there is that worry. And that, I think that's the bigger worry, is like, how are they going to live in wartime? How are they going to be able to feed their families? And so I think that's probably the overwhelming feeling on the ground. And we've seen, like, I think over 300 activists inside Iran sign a letter saying that they don't want war. And all this chat about war has actually prompted the IRGC intelligence arm to actually crack down on dissent in regards to any talk about a potential war. And so they've been arresting people, or at least threatening to arrest people, for talking about it on social media. And so they're very much trying to curb the conversation of dissent. And I think it's really noteworthy that on the same day that these events transpired, just days prior, Tehran's police had announced a new initiative to crack down on women that were violating mandatory hijab rules. So right now, for the past few days, we've seen that Iranian women are being treated with brute force. In one instance, we saw an Iranian woman who had a seizure, and it was being compared to the killing by security forces of Neda Agha Sultan, who was the de facto face of the 2009 Green Movement. And there's actually an online hashtag right now that's going viral in Iran called the Jang Ali Zanon, War Against the Women. So right now they're thinking about the war inside the country that's being fought by the clerical establishment against Iranian women as well.
It's VOA's Michael Lippin. He was speaking with Holly Douglas of the Atlantic Council. Despite regional and Western allies urging restraint, Israel has vowed to respond to Iran's unprecedented attack over the weekend. And Iran's president, in turn, has warned of a massive response to even the tiniest invasion on its territory. Lori London spoke with Itamar Rabinovich. He's a distinguished non-resident fellow with the Brookings Institution. He previously served as former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's ambassador to Washington about the risks of an even broader escalation in the region after months of unrest linked to the ongoing war in Gaza.
What are the risks here if Israel does strike territorial Iran? And could this tip the scales into a regional confrontation?
In theory, it could. It depends, of course, on the nature and scope of the response. And let's also make a distinction between the U.S. and several European and Arab governments urging Israel not to respond, and the Iranian leadership trying to threaten or frighten Israel by threatening an even more massive counterattack. But the reality is this, it's a dilemma. By responding, Israel risks an Iranian response and a cycle of violence, response followed by response, and so forth and so forth. By not responding, Israel would be corroding its deterrence and could be inviting other additional Iranian attacks in the future. Let's remember that, or bear in mind, that the Iranians became quite cocky in recent months. They fired missiles into Pakistan and into Syria couple of weeks ago, and they celebrated it, said we are a missile power and we can fire wherever we want. So that's a risky proposition for all of Iran's neighbors, and it needs to be dealt with either by Israel alone or by a coalition.
Iran said it was retaliating against an attack on its consulate in Damascus that started this latest.
That is correct, but you know, there are consulates and consulates. This was not exactly a diplomatic mission. It housed officers of the Revolutionary Force that has been organizing attacks on Israel from five proxies, all the way from Gaza through Lebanon, through Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. So did the Iranians think that they could just get away with it by using proxies, attacking Israel from five different directions and expect Israel not to respond?
Would a wider escalation have the potential to draw in the U.S. and other Western powers? And what would the repercussions for the region be?
Well, not necessarily. If Israel retaliates at the right scale, what is the right scale? The right scale is large enough not to be unimpressive and small enough not to require an Iranian response, and willing to see the issue as settled for now, then nothing much will happen. If they retaliate against Israel and Israel retaliates again, you know, it becomes a cycle. I hope Israel can deal with it by itself. But if they decide that they want to punish not just Israel, but the United States and the Arab countries that help block their attack on Israel and retaliate against Jordan or against the United Arab Emirates, these friends of the United States would expect the United States to help them. So, yes, there is a certain risk in that. And this is why President Biden has tried to weigh in his discussions with Prime Minister Netanyahu in order to prevent Israel from retaliating.
The situation is also drawing attention away from the continuation of the war in Gaza, which we know has been devastating on both sides and particularly for civilians in the territory. What does this mean for any sort of ceasefire talks, particularly since Hamas has said they don't even have 40 hostages to turn over in the categories for the latest deal that's on the table, women, children, elderly? Do you think ceasefire talks are even possible at this point?
I think they are possible. I think Hamas at this time is not interested. If they hear that the United States and others are trying to prevent Israel from going into Rafah, then they think that they have maybe time is on their side. So they are obviously not interested. And I wouldn't necessarily accept every word from Hamas as the ultimate truth. If they say they have only 20, I doubt it. But frankly, nobody knows how many of the Israeli hostages are still alive. One thing we know is that this is further delayed. Most of them, if not all of them, will not come back to Israel except in coffins.
Lori London hosts Issues in the News here at the Voice of America. She was speaking with former Israeli ambassador to the U.S. and Brookings Fellow Itamar Rabinovich. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The world's most populous democracy is getting ready to hold an election. We'll go there in a few minutes. First, though, Ukrainian officials confirmed an attack on a military airfield in occupied Crimea. Meanwhile, Ukrainians are optimistic about Speaker of the House Mike Johnson's moves to get a vote in the House of Representatives on American aid for Ukraine. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
The rescue operation in Chernihiv has come to an end following Wednesday's attack by Russian forces. Local authorities confirmed 18 people were killed and 78 injured as a result of the Russian shelling of several civilian buildings, including a local hospital. On the battlefield, the Ukrainian armed forces attacked a military airfield in the city of Jankoy in occupied Crimea on Wednesday. Ukrainian intelligence officials confirmed the attack, as did President Volodymyr Zelensky.
I would like to thank everyone in our armed forces of Ukraine who prepares special operations, especially important operations, crucial operations that destroy the equipment of the Russian army and their combat infrastructure. Today, the armed forces of Ukraine have carried out a correct strike against the occupier in Jankoy, targeting the airfield. Thank you, warriors. Thank you for your precision.
According to Ukrainian intelligence, as a result of the attack, four S-400 missile systems, three radar stations, air defense control point, and an airspace surveillance system were destroyed or critically damaged. In political news, Ukraine is getting more optimistic as U.S. Speaker of the House of Representatives Mike Johnson on Wednesday introduced separate bills on aid to American allies, including Ukraine. The Ukrainian package provides for the allocation of about $61 billion for aid to Kyiv and its allies. The final vote on the bills should take place by the evening of Saturday, April 20. U.S. President Joe Biden said he will sign the bills if Congress approves them. The ambassador of Ukraine to the United States, Oksana Markarova, revealed the details of the bill regarding the support of Ukraine by the United States. The bill includes a defense expenditure of $49.9 billion. $9.5 billion is also provided for economic aid to Ukraine and countries affected by Russian invasion of Ukraine. A separate provision of the draft law stipulates that the Biden administration should transfer long-range ATACMS missiles to Ukraine as soon as possible. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And for a look at what's in that bill that Speaker Johnson put forward, Maria Ulyanovska of VOA's Ukraine service spoke over Zoom with Doug Klain. He's a policy analyst at Raison for Ukraine and a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center.
So overall, this bill is very similar to what the Senate already passed. There are a couple of key differences in it, but none of them will detract from U.S. assistance to Ukraine in a serious or significant way. Many of these things that are different are meant to make this legislation more politically palatable for the Republican base and for the Republican Party as they grapple with the extent of Republican support for Ukraine. All of this is about Speaker Johnson trying to thread the needle to make sure that the base will follow and support whatever way that that they go, and also to ensure that former President Donald Trump, if not actively supports, at least does not actively oppose this effort.
There is skepticism in Ukraine. Ukrainian people, some of them think that Speaker Johnson is basically delaying help to Ukraine and does everything to do that. And we know that if this bill passes in the House of Representatives, it still has to go through Senate and then be signed by the president. So do you believe that this is a genuine effort from Speaker Johnson to send help to Ukraine? Or is it yet again just delaying this time?
My instinct is, if this was not a good faith effort to help Ukraine, then the bill that was released today would have differed much more from the Senate legislation. It is very, very similar to what the Senate already passed. There are different things that Speaker Johnson is doing to try to cloak this in political efficiency and political convenience. We will see what happens, but I don't think that anybody has much trust for Speaker Johnson's plans at this point. They have trust for what can actually pass and what can actually happen. If this plan does not work, if it is not viable, then the House is ready to use a discharge petition to bring the Senate-passed supplemental to the floor for a vote. And that is something that Republican members of Congress have said they are ready to do if this is not it. So this is Speaker Johnson's last chance to be part of the solution and not be sidelined. And he has a very real incentive to actually pass something here.
That's Maria Ulyanovska of VOA's Ukraine service. She was speaking with Doug Klain, a policy analyst at Raison for Ukraine and a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. Couple of election stories in the world today. First up, to Africa, where in Chad, residents are preparing for an election early next month. Reuters' David Doyle has that story.
Chad's opposition leader turned prime minister, Sucre Mazra, formally launched his bid for the presidency on Wednesday. The first round of an election meant to end 3 years of military rule is expected to take place on May 6th. In the capital, N'Djamena, Mazra said his was a grassroots campaign.
We're going out to meet Chadians to identify their demands, to exchange views with them, to dialogue with them.
Chad's interim leader, Mahamat Idriss Déby, seized power in 2021, following the battlefield death of his long-ruling father, Idriss Déby. Mazra had been one of the elder Déby's fiercest critics. He went into exile after dozens of his supporters were killed during clashes with the younger Déby's security forces. However, he has been consistently criticized by opposition figures since returning to Chad at Déby's invitation last year and being appointed as his prime minister. The upcoming vote's other main opposition contender, Albert Pehimi Padike, held a rally on Tuesday, at which he accused Mazra of collaborating with Déby. Concerns have also been raised about the conditions for the upcoming poll. Dabi is also standing and announced his candidacy days after another opposition politician, Yaya Dilo, was killed in an exchange of gunfire with security forces. Forensic experts have since said Dilo was likely shot at point-blank range.
It's David Doyle of Reuters reporting for us today. And finally, in India, the world's largest democracy is preparing for an election as well. Voting there begins on April 19th. The election will pit Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against an opposition alliance of more than two dozen parties. While Modi is wooing voters by promising to continue the country's development, the opposition has raised concerns about threats to democracy. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
Seeking a third term in office, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is highlighting economic growth and welfare measures for the poor as his biggest achievements. Modi says that in the last 10 years, his government has lifted 250 million people out of poverty, proving that it works to bring results. An opposition alliance led by the main opposition Congress Party that confronts Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party is flagging joblessness and what it says is a threat to the country's democratic and secular credentials. The India Alliance accuses Modi's party of weakening opposition ranks with corruption probes. A key leader, Delhi Chief Minister Arvind Kejriwal, was arrested weeks before the election in connection with graft allegations.
This election is a fundamentally different election. I don't think democracy has been as much at risk. The constitution has been as much at risk as it is today.
Nearly a billion voters will choose between the competing narratives offered by Modi and the opposition as the world's biggest election gets underway Friday. 10 years after taking power, Modi remains hugely popular. He is seen as a strong nationalist pro-Hindu leader who has fast-tracked development, boosted India's global stature, and delivered on promises like building a temple to Hindu Lord Ram.
The ruling alliance is very clearly going into this election on the shoulders of the Prime Minister's image. They are very clearly keeping the Modi factor right up in front. And that will help them to a certain extent offset possible anti-incumbency which has come in after 10 years.
India's fast-growing economy is bringing opportunities for some. But surveys show unemployment and inflation remain key concerns as it fails to create enough jobs.
I have hope for this country and I am staying here. I am here only, so yeah.
Surinder Ojha, a hawker who sells bags in a popular New Delhi market, says livelihood is a problem. But he feels that no government solves this problem for the poor. To woo voters, the main opposition Congress Party has promised to boost social spending and employment by giving government jobs and apprenticeships. Its leader, Rahul Gandhi, has led two cross-country marches to connect with people. But it is unclear whether that will translate into votes for the party, which was routed in the last two elections. Gandhi has not been projected as a prime ministerial candidate.
As far as Mr. Modi is concerned, there is no one on the opposite side to match him. And a lot of people who are dissatisfied today with the BJP rule and face economic hardship, unemployment, rising prices, they talk about it, but then will turn around and say, but who is there on the other side?
Surveys project Modi's BJP could surpass its 2019 performance. But the Congress Party says the results, due on June 4th, will be closer than expected. Anjana Pasricha, VOA News, New Delhi.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.